that moment of clarity was I was so tired of lying. I had got myself into a massive haul. The constant lying, you know, the constant promises that I'm going to stop and realizing that I couldn't. I'd been on, you know, a few days out with my friends. I was an everyday drinker. I couldn't stop. I would wake up with the jitters and the only thing that would calm it would be my vodka. Mm. And so the last 6 months of my drinking and using was every single morning. I had to have something to calm me. And I thought that was normal. You know, what part of that is normal?
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Michelle is a member of a Brit award-winning band, Liberty X, a mother of two, menopause advocate, and she's in recovery from addiction. And Michelle was part of a cast of the BAFTA and Emmy award-winning The Real for Monty, and she raised awareness for female cancers and shared her own journey. Michelle has presented across programs from Lorraine, This Morning, Loose Women, and most recently she's appeared on hit TV shows like Dancing on Ice. She's an author who wrote a book called Hot Flush, Motherhood, The Menopause and Me, and about the journey in early menopause. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. I'd love to thank you, Michelle, for coming on this podcast.
Thank
you. I'm very
you.
Privileged. It's a big subject for me, close to my heart, and I know it is to you. Mm. I know you, obviously, as a famous singer, award-winning band Liberty X, TV presenter, stage actress, or I should say actor, lots more, but I'd love you to introduce yourself, please, in your own words.
Okay. My name's Michelle Heaton. I was born in Gateshead in a council estate, and I had a relatively normal upbringing, and I always wanted to be a pop star. I never wanted to be an addict.
Yeah.
But I managed to be both. You know, who'd have thought? I was this little girl growing up in Gateshead and had this massive dream. I watched Bucks Fizz on the Eurovision and they took their skirts off. And I said to my mum, I'm going to be in a pop group one day. And I didn't have any other dream to fulfill but that. And I set my sights on it and somehow I made it happen.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I got to live my dream.
How sober are you today?
I am. Almost 3 years clean and sober.
I'd high five you, but I can't mention
Yay!
It. That's amazing. That's so fantastic. Such a good journey. I was going to ask you to paint us a picture. I sent you an email tonight.
I know, you did.
About your upbringing.
Can you send me an email that's like, on how the direction might go for this interview. And one of it was paint a picture of your upbringing. I thought you meant paint a picture.
It was probably not clear if I was writing it.
It wasn't clear at all. So I was like, I actually had a meeting last night. Anyway, I was sharing it. So I came this morning, I was like, to your producer, I'm sorry, I haven't painted a picture. And she's like, what do you mean?
Bless. I'm sorry about that. But I will ask you, what was it like to be brought up as a young Michelle? Mm-hmm. In Gateshead with that dream?
You know, I didn't have the best upbringing when it comes to, you know, money. You know, we had very, very little. I didn't know any different. I didn't go to stage school. I didn't have dancing or singing lessons. I just knew that I loved singing and that I wanted to perform. So music was a massive part of my upbringing. My escapism was with music. Whenever the radio was on, I'd imagine myself in a different place. I just felt like there was more. I didn't quite fit in. And, you know, being sober for almost 3 years and talking to other people who have had addiction problems, they often feel like they don't fit in or that they, you know, they're supposed to do something different or that they didn't know who they were. And I definitely had that. I just knew what I wanted to do. And then I just set my sights on it. And I sang in every competition that I could go to. I went to auditions. And then along came pop stars after, you know, a number of years trying.
Was that 21?
Yeah, that's right. Well, 2000 was when Pop Stars, the TV show, was made. And 20, 2001. I can't even pronounce it properly. Look at us.
2021.
Oh my God, 2021. 2001 was when Liberty X started to make music.
So 2001 was when I was living in LA, mm-hmm. and I was on the last decline of my using.
That's right. So how long have you got in sobriety?
Soon I'll be 20 years.
It's amazing. Well done.
I know. It's really good stuff. I'm really happy about it.
Good. You should be. You should be. Because not a lot of people make that. You know, not a lot of people make what I have. I mean, coming out of rehab, we've lost one already. He was gone, you know, died of an overdose.
It's usually one in three from rehab, isn't it?
Yeah.
When I was in there, they said, look to your right, look to your left. One of you is going to die.
Yeah.
One's going to have a rough time.
Yeah.
And one of you will make it.
Yeah.
And I think I asked about the stats, and the reason being is because a lot of people go into rehab for a holiday
or a break. I saw that.
Oh, I'll just dust myself off and I'll go back out there and do what I was doing before.
Yeah, exactly. And there were people like that in there with me. Usually like the younger ones, you know, whose family, you know, pay for it time and time again. And then they just see it as a get out of jail free card. But then there was a lot of people in there like me who was trying to live and not die, you know.
And it's funny because when I'll go back to when you first discovered alcohol, but for me... how I got to rehab was I was on the back of a 3-day bender after really, really trying to stop. And I got down to sort of a 3-day loop, as I called it. Okay. So I'd go out on 3 days. I'd sleep and barely eat for 2 days. Mm-hmm. And then it'd happen again. That was really in the last 8 months, a year, but definitely the last 6 months. And I went to, there's a whole story with it, but basically, I'd come to and I just had enough. I was on the phone to someone, I didn't even know who it was. Apparently it was someone from Drug Helpline.
Wow.
And I was like, why are you phoning me? He said, no, you phoned me.
Wow.
I was like, right. Anyway, I went to a friend's house who is a sober man, a really cool guy. And I literally opened the door and I burst out crying. First time I've ever asked for help. Mm-hmm. And I just said, I have a really bad cocaine and drug problem. What can you help me? What do I do? And that's how we drove into treatment. What was your moment?
It was actually very similar to yourself. I wasn't a binger, you know, like the way that you described your drinking and using. It wasn't like that for me, which kept me, you know, away from asking for help a lot of the times because I was comparing myself to other people and I'm not like them and I'm not on a park bench and I haven't lost my family and my house and I'm still kind of working. So whatever excuse I could find to not be an alcoholic addict, I would find. But that moment of clarity was I was so tired of lying. I had got myself into a massive hole. The constant lying, you know, the constant promises that I'm going to stop and realizing that I couldn't. I'd been on, you know, a few days out with my friends. I was an everyday drinker. I couldn't stop. I would wake up with the jitters and the only thing that would calm it would be my vodka. Mm. And so the last 6 months of my drinking and using was every single morning. I had to have something to calm me. And I thought that was normal. You know, what part of that is normal? Because you convince yourself. And when you're convinced yourself that you've got it together and that you're in control, it's very easy then to convince other people who are very worried. Like everybody else around me knew what I suffered with. Had told me, but I couldn't hear it. But I couldn't see what I suffered with because I was so good at convincing myself that I was all right. But that moment of I just had enough. I just don't know what it was. Nothing that different. It wasn't a massive big rock bottom. I had many, many more serious complications in the hospital previous to that. I was with my friend, Katie Price. And at that time, she was sober. And we've been best friends for a long, long, long time. And I saw that she had something that I wanted. And I asked her for help. And I said, I want, you know, she asked me, do you want what I've got? Do you want to be sober? I'm like, yeah, I can't do this anymore. And then we got the ball rolling and went to treatment.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It's when you see somebody else that you have, you know, a relationship with that you know that they were or can be as bad as you, and then being sober. It took me to see that, to realize that maybe I could do it too.
That's what I had a similar thing with, as a friend of mine we used to party with, and I used to say to him, you should really slow down a little bit. Mm. I used to tell him, and he's like, no, I think it's you actually that has a problem.
Yeah.
And we'd be in a bathroom, powdering our noses, talking about who's got a worse problem.
Wow, it's mad, isn't
it? It's really crazy. But yeah. A friend of mine did get sober before me, and it was literally, if you can do it, I can do it. Mm-hmm. One of those things, you know. I had a similar upbringing, but London, I'm a rare Londoner in London. And I call it a normal upbringing.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of booze around. Mm. My dad was a docker, my grandfather was. And my grandfather was definitely an alcoholic and proper gambler. Mm-hmm. Gambled a lot of houses away and whatnot. And I swore I'd never drink because for me, the guys that I looked up to, would once they've took a drink, it'll either turn into violence.
Right.
Or you'd just be like a crazy mess and just scary stuff. Like is when you're a kid, it's scary stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember my father coming home one day and undoing the fire, thinking there was a leak and just leaving the gas on in the house. And I'm like a kid thinking, can we put it on? What'd you do? And too scared to say anything, you know?
So you wanted to be the opposite. You wanted to 100%. Just stay away from what you saw and what you knew.
Completely. So for me to turn into someone who was an alcoholic and addict, it was... When I realized it, I cried. I was just like, what happened? How did that happen? What happened to this bright kid that didn't want to be like that?
Yeah.
And so I say that I weaned myself on alcohol through relationships and wanting to belong, peer pressure, things like that. How did you and when did you discover alcohol?
So I suppose an alcoholic or addict wasn't part of my story at the beginning. My mum and dad weren't alcoholics. It's not run in my family. I didn't have anything bad happen. There was no childhood trauma. I drank when I was about 16, went out when I was 17. Everything was relatively normal. Like even at the start of the band, I loved drinking. Don't get me wrong. Like I loved, if I could drink like a normal person, I still would. I'd be lying if I didn't say that.
Good luck trying.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. I don't want to tempt fate and I'm not going to start trying. You know, because it was good. Like life was good with alcohol at a certain point. And I drank a lot, but then I would stop. And I didn't drink the next couple of days to get over a hangover. Like life was pretty normal.
But what age did you first drink?
I think it was about maybe 14. I think I had my first drink at a friend's New Year's Eve party. And I remember it was Bailey's and that yellow stuff that you make snowballs with.
Yeah.
And obviously it all came up the next day and I vowed never to drink again. And I didn't until I was 16, 17 when, you know, when you started to go out to pubs and nightclubs and date and stuff.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a massive part of my life. It was more of a social aspect. It wasn't really until, kind of similar to yourself, that I made myself drink more. It was when I had my hysterectomy, which was 10 years ago now almost. Yeah. And, you know, after all of the highs and lows of the bands, yes, there was lots of drinking and drugs and whatever, but it was all recreational. It was nothing, something that was an absolute problem. And then I hit menopause and I felt like I didn't know who I was anymore. You know, I didn't have friends who were menopausal because I had the hysterectomy. So it was like 15, 20 years before my peers.
Yeah.
And I felt like I wasn't relatable. I was always tired. I was emotional. I was, you know, everything was just felt an effort when a few weeks beforehand, I was full of life. And I found that when I drank, I felt more like me or what I thought was more like me. And then I was able to have those conversations with people that wasn't around menopause. And I was able to be that life and soul of the party again. And then somewhere along that 7-year period, I just was an alcoholic. I couldn't tell you when it switched. It just became progressive. And with cocaine, that was later. Very quick. It just had me quick. Yeah. But it was alcohol that was going to kill me. It was alcohol that would brought me to my knees.
It's funny because some people say that, first of all, it's like an aha moment, which I never had.
Mm.
But I had certain ominous warnings where I remember going out one night all the way through the clock and then going back to the pub in the morning, drinking, thinking, oh, that's interesting. like I can feel all right. For me, I had stuff happen when I was younger. So later on, it worked out to be more of a painkiller. Right. Where in the beginning, it was more of belonging to everyone. I could talk. I felt taller, better looking, like funnier, even though I probably wasn't, and all the other stuff.
Exactly the same.
But as you described, because menopause must be horrendous, what you went through. I couldn't imagine. But did it become a painkiller then for you, the alcohol?
It became a relief. It made me forget how different I was to my friends.
Yeah.
Because I was very different. And I was going through, you know, hormone shifts and big life-changing moments that my friends, in fact, not being horrible at all, but like didn't really want to hear. You know, who wants to sit down with their friend, like 30-something-year-old, around the bar and talk about how menopausal I felt? You know, it was just not really topic conversation. So I had to find other ways to be involved with the people that I wanted to hang around with. And it was always about alcohol. And same with you, you know, I didn't have a, wow, I feel like I've arrived. It wasn't that. It was just part of my life that enabled me to do things that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And feel part of.
How do you feel now? Like, what's your mindset as you are today to say 5 years ago?
Wow. I mean, the thing is that it's a disease of the mind and allergy of the body, isn't it? We say in recovery.
Yeah.
And I wasn't mindful at all 5 years ago. The things that I now know I did, you know, a lot of it was blackout. I didn't even know I was in blackout. The things that I did was incomprehensible. The pain that I put my family through and my kids. Not that they really have a recollection. They were a bit younger of how mummy was so sick, but they knew mummy was sick.
Mm.
And that in itself, you know, my doing. But my mindset now is it's shifted so much. I honestly never thought I could stop drinking. I thought that this was it. I had accepted that my life was going to end like this because I saw no way out. I felt there was absolutely no way out of waking up and drinking in the morning. And now on the other side, you know, there is a solution.
Mm.
You know, there are ways of recovering. And that if I can do it, other people can. And I think like the mind is a great thing. You know, when it's clear of any other influences, you can do anything that you want to do. Because you don't have that influence.
It's you know, part of doing this podcast is that hopeless state that people are in, that I experienced, where abnormal becomes normal.
Yeah.
Like what you said. And things like I'd drive somewhere thinking, I'm not going to go into the pub today, I'm just going to go there. And the next thing I'll be at the bar drinking, thinking, how did I get here?
Yeah.
Like seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And if I heard someone saying that to me, I'd be like, oh, come on, you're winding me up or you're making it up. But it's what happens. And I really think that we run in our subconscious because we're not conscious anymore because it's too painful.
Yeah.
And we need to try and find that relief. Well, I can speak for myself.
Yeah, no, very similar to me. You know, I would set out the day to not drink or at least not drink until tea time and have a glass. And by midday, you know, I had already broken that promise to myself. Go out and drive places because I'm not going to drink and then have to get a taxi home and then drag my poor husband out of bed the next morning to go get the car. You know, what I put him through, you know, he doesn't drink. He's never tasted alcohol before. When we first met, I thought, wow, this is not going to work.
I'm going to test him on that one.
This isn't going to work at all. Yeah. And then, you know, I've become an alcoholic. But what pain we put other people through.
Yeah.
We cannot see it. You know, like I'm a good mom. I love my kids. I love my husband. I'm a great friend. But in addiction, I'm none of those.
Yeah.
But I couldn't see it. I could not see the pain that I caused other people because I was addicted to alcohol.
Well, that's the thing that's misunderstood is because my dad would say, oh, we'll just stop drinking, it'll be okay, even though he was a heavy drinker. Yeah. But when you're mind is obsessed of survival. You go on fight or flight, don't you, really?
Yeah.
And you're on survival of how to get away with this, how to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, I believe that the subconscious doesn't know the difference from right or wrong or true or false. And it's just trying to survive. But I wanted to ask you about when you hit fame, did that affect you in any way? Did that give you a warning of like, oh, maybe I should slow down? Or was it like, yeah, great, I've got this and I've got this?
I think with fame, it brought... I didn't have a great time at the beginning of the band with like press and stuff. I loved my job and, you know, being famous wasn't something that I set out to be. It was to be a singer. And you hear that a lot with the bands that are around our era. It's different now. Yeah. You know that it's all about fame.
Yeah.
But with that came, you know, a lot of more opportunities to party and things like that. But for me, at that point, I was suffering with stimming pill addiction, and ephedrine. And
oh
an eating
my
disorder.
God! Sorry to talk there over you.
Yeah, does that ring a bell?
Oh my God! No one talks about ephedrine.
Wow!
So
there you go.
So I used to train at a gym.
Mm-hmm.
With there was this guy called he's really lovely. He's Carlton Leach. He's wrote loads of books about being one of the hardest guys in Britain and stuff, or books written about him. We used to go to this gym, and instead of having a protein shake, you'd basically have ephedrine pills.
Yeah, that's where I found mine at gym.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize when I did my story in rehab, I said, yeah, you know, maybe a couple of years I've been doing something. And when I really did it, I was like, oh no, I was training on ephedrine.
Yes.
Way back before I was 20.
Yes.
Training, going out all night on it, drinking, didn't touch the sides with ephedrine.
Yes.
You're the first person who said that.
Yeah, I took it predominantly to lose weight.
Yeah.
Because I was bigger than the other girls in the band. And it actually gave me a heart problem. And I still have atrial fibrillation. And I had to have a loop recorder on my heart for 2 years. And I've been in and out of different tests and stuff because of ephedrine. Mm. So like, whilst I wasn't an alcoholic or cocaine addict at that point in my life, I was in active addiction in other ways. Ephedrine, like say, slimming pills, speed in college before that. But I was obsessed with whatever it was, whether it was binge eating, not eating, ephedrine, whatever my thing was, I've been obsessed with that thing. Being a pop star was my obsession when I was growing up. So I've had the obsession of the mind for all my life on whatever that is that I'm fixated on.
You know what? It's funny because I used to say to my mum when I was really young, I'm sure I've got adrenaline problems, mum. She's like, why? You're fine. I was so obsessed when I was boxing. I boxed for 5 years and competed for British title and stuff. And I would run to the gym. I'd spar 10 rounds with whoever was there, do my stuff, run home. And I'd be doing sit-ups, eating food, just to get some food in, just to make sure I'm okay. I was so obsessed with that.
Yeah.
And I think it stood me in good stead because my bones and body's made it through okay. But for work, for the first 8 years, I never stayed in one country more than 2 months. Mm. And I think that's why I did really well, because I was like, right, Paris is not happening. I'm going to go to Milan. Mm-hmm. That's not happening. I'm going to go there. And I think partly that obsession to do really well kind of kept me out of harm's way relatively for that period of time.
Yeah.
And then after that, I kind of felt like I'd made it. Mm-hmm. And I was patting myself on the back. And that's when things started to just go down that
because
way for me.
It's cunning, baffling, and it just gets you. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had like periods of sobriety. When I say periods, I mean days. And if I had a good day, I would reward myself with a bad day. And because I never drank when I was pregnant, whilst I wouldn't say I was in active addiction back then, it kind of made me see that there wasn't any problems. Or if I went on holiday, you know, there wasn't any way to get other things. Mm. And whilst I wasn't using, obsession was always there. I remember that the thought of getting something or vodka was almost more enticing than the actual product itself. That need and obsession to get something, knowing that you're on your way to get it, was almost a bigger high, because the rest of it was never like the first drink. You know, we never got what we were searching for. And then when we got ourselves into that predicament where we're looking for that first rush, what alcohol made me feel like at the very beginning, you've tried and tested it for so long, your body's dependent on it, you know, obsession of the mind. I'm there. I'm already in addiction, not realizing it. For how long it took me to get into that, I don't know. But before long, you're there.
Yeah. It's an invisible line you cross, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I remember seeing some friends that used to do lots of coke and drink, and I used to think, how can you do that all night and go through the night and stuff when I like to train? And then one day that was me.
Mm.
And I was so ashamed. Yeah. So ashamed of that, actually. How do you maintain a strong sobriety?
So I follow a 12-step program and I attend my meetings. I have a sponsor, I have sponsees. I'm actively working. You know, I wake up every day and I pray to a God of my misunderstanding for a clean and sober day. And then when I go to bed at night, I say thank you. You know, I try and pull myself up when my attitudes aren't good. I can still be absolutely insane and do things that are completely uncalled for and react quickly and shout and yell. Like, I'm not perfect. Like, being sober doesn't mean that all of a sudden you're superhuman and that you're like the object of perfection. But it means that with sobriety and the tools that I've been given in recovery means that I can recognize that weary thinking quicker and say sorry or clean up my mess. Whereas before, when you're this massive big wrecking ball, you just continue to wreck things because you can't see the consequences in front of you. So, you know, I suppose I maintain my sobriety pretty much because I'm not going back.
For those of you, it's funny because I said to you earlier about I used to live in a house in LA where they had meetings and I'd be coming at 6 o'clock in the morning saying, hey lads, how are you doing? And they'd be asking, Paul, you've obviously been out again. I'd be like, yeah, whatever. And I didn't understand that that was a 12-step meeting.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what 12-step was or is.
Me neither.
So for those who don't know, who are listening to this, a 12-step program started in 1934 for people with alcohol addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
By a doctor and a stockbroker and Carl Jung.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a success ever since and helped millions of people get sobriety around the world.
Yeah.
160 different languages and stuff. And it's really a spiritual program, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And people that do it are not affiliated. We can't talk for them or anything like that.
No, we've got to be careful about what we talk about.
Yeah.
And
there's a famous story about, I asked why, because anonymity is obviously necessary, but I was outed by the papers anyway.
Me too.
Yeah. Congratulations. So I thought, let's use this as a platform to help others who may not have heard of it or understand how it works.
Yeah.
I watched a clip of you the other day and I must say I welled up but high-fived you at the same time.
Okay.
And it was when you was on Lorraine
and
you were apologising for how you were and you drunk on the show.
Yeah.
It makes me emotional now because I know what it's like. Was that something that was sitting on your chest that you needed to say, or was it an organic moment that just come out?
It was an organic moment. I was doing my step nines around the same time, so I knew what saying sorry for the wrongs that I've done was. But right there in that moment, it was completely organic. I just had a moment there. I'm looking at Lorraine, and it's the first time from what I can remember anyway, that I'm looking at her in the eyes without having a drink before the show.
Yeah.
And I had been a repeat guest on Lorraine for numerous things. I wasn't always drunk. I didn't always drink before the show, but it was the first time that I had been sober for quite some time. And I said sorry to her because she took me under her wing and trusted me with segments for the show that were really empowering to women and bring the bra campaign about breast cancer and things like that. Now, whilst I wasn't drunk on those campaigns, I had been drinking before some studio appearances and I felt like I owed her an apology. And it wasn't just about Lorraine, who's been a friend of ours for many, many years. It was about like people who were watching that I had let people. You know, you do feel like you let people down. Of course you do. You know, they say it's hard to, don't sit in remorse or self-pity. And it's not like a self-pity thing, but it's understandable that we feel guilty about what we've become and how we let people down. And sometimes, more than often, as you probably know, is that when you say sorry, their reaction is what for?
Mm.
Because they don't really know what you're apologizing for. And they were taken aback. But I meant every word of it.
I could see that. It really touched me because I remember I flew to New York to apologize to a photographer that gave me an incredible start of my career. Mm. And I flew to LA to do a shoot with him, and we were staying in Chateau Marmont.
Yeah.
And with a friend of mine, and he'd never been there. So I was like, oh, dude, there's a great bar over the road, and there's this and there's that. And let's just go out for one, probably 11 o'clock. And we came back at 3 after everything was shut, killed the mini bar.
Yeah.
And was just sitting by the port at 6 o'clock in the morning, and the RV was there ready to go.
Right.
And all I did was sleep on the job, on the bonnet of a F-150 pickup truck. And my picture for that campaign was sleeping on the truck. And I really wanted to make an amends to the photographer. And I just broke down. I was like, I am so sorry. I really am. I'm like, it was not intended. Mm. I just got carried away of doing this stuff. And he was really gracious, but he was the same. He's like, you know what? I'm just happy for you.
That's been my experience
with
the most part of my apologies. And most people just want you to stay sober.
Yeah.
That's all they want. You know, like my friends in particular, like, you don't have to say sorry. But now do you understand why we had to step away? Because friends stepped away and I pushed them away.
Mm.
And I blamed them, you know, for walking away. How dare they? They're not my friends. They don't care. But they couldn't stand me kill myself. They couldn't watch it anymore. And that's why they had to take a stand back. And unfortunately, it took sobriety for me to realize that.
Yeah, which is a lovely thing about it. It's funny because I made an amends to my dad, and he's like, oh, that's what boys do anyway, and just walked off and said, do you want tea?
Yeah.
It's like, no, but I really want to say stuff.
Yeah. Oh, no, my mum, bless her, my mum wanted a grandeur. I took her away to Tenerife to say sorry.
Oh, bless
her. She wanted a whole day out of it.
How do you deal with stress? Because for me, I know I've done a lot of research on addiction and alcoholism and how we process alcohol completely different from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
You process the acetaldehyde completely different.
Yeah.
Therefore, it forms in what's like a craving. So you need to have more in your body, which blew my mind when I realized that. Yeah. And also shattering my nervous system through ephedrine and coke and stuff. I was literally just shattered.
Yeah.
And to get that back down, it took a long time. So if I'm tired, or I do a little morning meditation as well. I used to be obsessed, like, I've got to do 40 minutes in the morning and 40 minutes at night, and everything's got to be. But it was through fear.
Exactly. Fear of going back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had that experience as well. And I really put myself into, you know, action and into the rooms and things like that. I still do. But more so at the beginning, I was scared of my own shadow. And that's also not really a place that's safe, you know, scared of doing anything that could trigger me. Whilst I took myself away from places where I could be triggered at and stopped going out for quite some time and things like that, that's not where you need to stay. And I think that's really important to say this, because life isn't boring. I can still now do all the things that I want to do. I can go and party with the best of them without drinking or using now. Had you told me that 3 years ago, I mean, I would have been drunk before I went out anyway. You wouldn't have got me out the house without me already have had, you know, easily half a bottle of vodka. But I still enjoy myself. I get to leave when I want to.
Mm.
I get to leave before all you idiots get drunk around me and stagger home. And I have the power to say no to things. Like, my answer was always yes, because fear of missing out as well. And also that enables me to drink more. If I was out partying, nobody would question my drinking. But I can say no now and nobody questions it.
And that's a really powerful place to be.
Yeah.
It's funny when someone says to you, though, I get this. You sure you don't want one? What's the matter with you? Have you got what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
I'll drink you under the table. And I'm like, it's like, I say to my friends, it's like a kid with a little sort of tiny car that he thinks he's fast, asking an F1 driver if he wants to have a race.
Yeah.
And the guy doesn't race anymore. You're like, no, I'm okay, buddy. Yeah. It's all right.
Yeah. Do you know what? Usually, especially if I'm like in restaurants or things like that, I would usually just go, I'm an alcoholic. And they sit with that. And I have to say, about 8 times out of 10, they stand there and chat with me because either they've had problems or one of their family have had problems. Yeah. And it's everywhere. You know, if we open the narrative, which this is doing, and podcasts like this, we open the conversation and it's everywhere. Somebody we know or ourselves are always suffering, but they don't know how to talk about it unless the conversation's opened up. And, you know, this is a great starting point. This is where people can come and hear that their story's being told by somebody else. And when you hear that and you relate to it, that's when people can ask for help.
And that's why I think you're so brave, because like I said, you know, it's amazing your sobriety, but I couldn't get out the front door initially. I was too scared. Mm. You know, I think I was so shy and sort of traumatized by what I went through in the end that, yeah, I couldn't do what we're doing now. But for me, it's really important that people hear. Because if I could sit in my house back then and listen to someone that has your courage and your experience in talking about sobriety, it would have given me a kind of, oh, actually, maybe if they can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
Or I didn't even know about it anyway. So it's a nice to bring this into someone's front mm. room, or if they're on a tube, listen to a podcast.
Yeah. I think the thing is like, you know, for us, our anonymity was broken. Mine, very similar to yours. I was in the Priory and somebody was telling a story about me. And so whilst I'm trying to get, you know, not die in the Priory, there's like a phone call from my agent to the Priory saying that I need to take this call and this story's going to be in the newspaper in a couple of days unless I give them a counteracting story. So unless I tell my story in my words, which I did, then somebody else was going to tell my story in their words and it was, you know, obviously fabricated. So I did it. I did my own story of how I'm in recovery while I'm in recovery. Like, it's just mind-boggled that my back was that far against the wall.
Yeah.
But how I was absolutely not going to let somebody else who was a friend, and I know who they are, tell the world my story of how I'm an addict. That was just not going to happen. So we chose as a family, me and my husband, that I would say that. So in that, it's helped me open up the narrative to be able to talk to people like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, call it courageous or whatever. You know, at the beginning, I had no choice. You know, it's not ideal. You know, I didn't really want everybody to know that I was an alcoholic or that I was suffering from a drug issue. Like, of course you don't. You know, in that itself, you think doors are going to close, that I'm not going to be able to work.
Yeah.
That fear kept me away from asking for help for some amount of years. But in my experience, with time, it didn't happen overnight. I've had more opportunities being sober than I ever had before in my career. You know, I was on Dancing on Ice. I did SAS, Who Dares Wins. Mm. I am trusted with other parents' kids at parties and I'm, you know, reliable today. Those opportunities for those two particular TV shows, I had been up for a few years. I was just never going to get it because I was a mess. I was a hot mess. So things have come my way that I didn't think was ever going to come my way. And that only came because I was sober.
No, I love that because it was my fear as well. I did incredibly well for the 90s or the noughties into 2000, peaked in my business, which was amazing. And I thought, I'm never going to go back to work. But when I did, and I went back honestly, and same thing happened. Someone put stuff in the newspapers. I was part of the phone tapping scandal.
Yeah.
That's done with, sorted out in court. So it was really difficult to sit there with my parents and have a double page spread of my addiction or whatever. Because they really never knew, because I lived away for so long.
Yeah,
so it was never on their front door. Yeah, and it was horrible for them to learn. But to use this in a positive way is great. And I want to say as well, for me, I went back to modelling at 35, which is quite vintage. Within 3 years, had made more money and success than I did quite a way before.
Yeah.
And that blew my mind because I went to work to be of service to the people and enjoy it and just try and connect again. Because I realized that I'd go there just for me and for the wrong reasons. Mm. And then I went back for the right reasons and success comes to those people. I really believe that.
Yeah, so I too.
Don't let that stop you. coming into sobriety, because actually it works in your favour.
It works quite the opposite to what I assumed it would be like. And, you know, coming into recovery, I had no idea what recovery looked like. If I'm being honest, I didn't say I was an alcoholic the first week in rehab. And definitely not cocaine addict. Like, drank a lot. I don't think I need to be here. Dabbled in coke a little bit. Like, it was just like all of these things. And then when I came out of it, I'm like fully blown everything. And it felt freeing.
Yeah.
I was just so scared of what people were going to think of those labels, because all I knew of those labels was what you associate with alcoholism. And I do think, like, in the last 3 years in particular, that a lot more people, you know, with status has came out and said that they're on the sober journey or have been for many years and now I'm able to talk about it. It has changed the narrative. And I think a lot more people are coming to believe that this is something that they can do as well. My fear is that through COVID, because I was in addictions way before COVID, it just escalated it a little bit for me. But for those who found alcohol or drugs through COVID, which there will be millions of, because use that, you know, how many millions of people are going to be needing help and not realizing it for years to come off the back of that? So I think we're going to have a real surge of this, which we haven't actually come to see yet. I think it's going to be in the future.
I totally agree. And that brings me to, I saw you talking about rehabs.
Yes.
Who's rehabs? How does that work? And what's your association with them?
So I got hired by Rehubs to be their YouTube interviewer. So I get to interview people like yourself or professors of universities that have written books like What's Behind Us and explained, you know, the illness to us the way that you just did about what happens to the brain and things like that. And it's basically an online rehab. So, you know, when I went to rehab, I was taking it out of the home. And whilst my husband was there for the kids, it's not always going to be easy for everybody.
Yeah.
And when I came out of rehab, I'm then back in the home and I'm like, oh my God, what do I do? How do I behave? So it's about offering a rehab services online while you're in the same context of where you're going to be living your sober life. So you don't come out and shock yourself into normal living. You have to live your normal life while doing the program.
And if you have a job or you have a family, exactly. You can't always go away for 28 days.
Exactly. Not everyone's going to have the same situation that we did. You know, we had to lend money to pay for my rehab, but we were able to pay for it. It's not everyone's case. So this is a bit more inexpensive as well. Single parent families, those who have to work, you know, to bring in the money for the family. It's just a great alternative. And actually success rate from their perspective has been quite high, given the fact that you take it in your own surroundings. And it kind of makes sense to me. Yeah.
Just a quickie, I wanted to ask you, I think your husband's a legend.
Oh, he gets that all the time.
I'm sorry to say, but I really think he is, because I've been on the other side of the foot too. And I think he sounds like a very stoic, stand-up gentleman. You must feel lucky to have him.
I am very, very lucky. I mean, I can't believe he stuck around for all of it, but he did. And, you know, there's a letter that he wrote me when I went into rehab, and I say it in meetings and shares sometimes. And, you know, a lot of it is hard to read because I don't recognise myself. But what he said was that he knew I was there somewhere. And whilst he couldn't help me, he had to stay strong for the kids. I get emotional when I think about it. But that he knew I was there. He just was waiting until I realised that I needed help. And I've got an amazing, amazing man.
It's amazing because he can see you there. I can see you there now, you know. And it's lovely because it's weird, you come from such a dark place to being present. I can look you in the eye.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to look people in the eye before.
Oh my gosh. No.
And now it's nice. I don't feel uncomfortable because I've got nothing to hide.
Yeah.
I feel proud of myself. Last question is, whoever's listened to this, if they have a problem they're currently in, they're in denial of it or whatever, what advice would you give to them about how to get help or where to go?
Yeah. I mean, obviously we just mentioned Rehub, so they have a call line, but visit the website, aa.org. You know, when I first came into recovery and I wanted to find out where my nearest meetings was, get yourself to a meeting. It's all explained in there. And know that there is help out there, but you got to want it. So it's not going to work if you're doing it for anybody else. You know, you've lost a job, the employer's trying to tell you to go there. You need to be at the point where you really want to change and take action. And there is help out there for people listening. And I promise you, you know, if I can do it, you can. I was about to die. Like, no, I can't swear, can I? But no shit's given. Like, I was about to die. Like, I was literally days away. I was dead, pretty much. My liver was on the onset of sclerosis. My pancreas still doesn't work. I was a shell. And from someone who was drinking neat vodka every single day, and blood was coming up and so forth, to being here 3 years later and being fit and healthy, it's mad. But I can do. You can do that. Yeah. It is possible to live a life without drink or drugs.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Michelle. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you to my guest, Michelle Heaton. If you want to find out more about her, check out the show notes. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Marti, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.
I'm Elizabeth Day, the creator and host of How to Fail. It's the podcast that celebrates the things in life that haven't gone right and what, if anything, we've learned from those mistakes to help us succeed better. Each week, my guests share three failures, sparking intimate, thought-provoking and funny conversations. You'll hear from a diverse range of voices sharing what they've learned through their failures. Join me Wednesdays for a new episode each week. This is an Elizabeth Day and Sony Music Entertainment original podcast. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.